Good morning and welcome to the Court of Appeals. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Peter M. Reyes Jr., Judge Kevin G. Ross, Judge Randall J. Sleater, the Honorable Peter M. Reyes Jr. presiding.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Good morning.
And I assume that you can see all three of us as well.
Yes.
Okay, good. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, May 21st, 2020. We are holding oral arguments via WebEx versus being in person pursuant to the order that we're following from the Minnesota Supreme Court in terms and with respect to the pandemic that we now are under. We appreciate the fact that all of you are accommodating the change in circumstances here. We realize this is not ideal, but we do appreciate you participating via WebEx for these oral arguments. Consistent with what we have done in the past, we will have 15 minutes for appellant to start, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal by appellant, if you so choose. What we have done is we have a timer in one of the windows, so you can see it, so you see how much time that you have. As a reminder, once you begin, we'll set the timer and then we'll have a few seconds to reset it for the next party to go ahead. With that, unless anybody has any questions.
No, not at this time, Your Honor.
Okay. Okay, so counsel for appellant, if you can please state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and this is also being recorded as well so people can hear the oral arguments afterwards. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Delmar Flynn, counsel for appellants, CJR and MJR. May it please the court. The district court's orders on October 10th, 2019 and January 27th, 2020 should be reversed because the district court erred as a matter of law in waiving the requirement for putative father to initiate a paternity action pursuant to the Minnesota Fathers Adoption Registry, MFAR. The court erred for two reasons. First, the court incorrectly applied the good cause exception under MFAR, and second, the court relied on an invalid recognition of parentage, or ROP. As to the first point.
Counsel, actually, can you start on the second one? You said that that father cannot rely on an invalidly filed ROP?
I stated invalid recognition of parentage, not necessarily filed. I would say the entire document itself is invalid because it was signed by a party who did not have legal standing, Your Honor.
And I'm assuming you're referring to mother.
Correct, mother who had no legal standing following her execution of an adoption consent that became irrevocable.
Okay, so I'm looking at Minnesota Statutes 259.49 with respect to notice, and subdivision 1B7, read in conjunction, states in essence that notice of a hearing upon a petition to adopt a child must be given to the parent of a child if, under subdivision 7, the person, not the mother of the child, has signed a recognition of parentage under Section 275.75, which has not been revoked or vacated. So, is that the provision that you're saying is invalid or had been invalidly invoked? Or are you saying the 275.75 recognition of parentage, that is invalid?
Correct, Your Honor.
Which one?
I would argue, I apologize, the screen just went out. I would argue that the recognition of parentage itself was invalid. And at the time that the notices of adoption went out, number 7 didn't even apply because there was no recognition of parentage executed or attempted to be executed at the time. So I'm speaking to the recognition of parentage, not the application of paragraph 7 under 259.49.
Okay, so what provision under, now I'm looking now at 257.75, recognition of parentage. What portion of that statute had not been complied with?
Your Honor, I would ask that the court view this as more the, this doesn't even apply because it requires the legal standing of the signer at the time. So to look outside the statute and state that the consent completely trumps the application of 257.75, the entire thing, because once the consent became revoked at the time that she signed it in January of 2019, there is no way that a recognition of parentage could take place after the fact, because it would have effectively revoked the ROP, and there's no legal basis for that revocation absent of fraud.
But those are two separate issues. What she signed was a consent to pre-adoptive custody. And custody is different than a recognition of parentage. What we have under 275.75 and then subsequently in 259.49 is whether a parent, and in this case the father, is going to be recognized in some way as a parent. So why is whether or not mother signs a pre-adoptive custody document, why would custody affect a recognition of parentage?
I would disagree with that, Your Honor, respectfully, to state that the adoption consent specifically to, I would point to 259.24, or I'm sorry, maybe it's 259.47.
I know, there are a lot of statutes involved here.
I think it's 259.47. Basically, where the adoptive parent's custody is subject to the birth parent's until the consent becomes revocable. And then other jurisdictions have treated consents to say that the only residue from the consent is the duty to pay support. So that doesn't allow for legal standing to be affecting other documents.
Right. And I understand. I'm sorry. Sorry, Ms. Flynn. I understand that you're citing to, you referenced a case in Massachusetts, I believe, and one in Oregon, talking about that. But I think that's later in the process. What I'm trying to understand is mother signed a pre-adoptive custody agreement, which became irrevocable for her. But that's just for pre-adoptive custody. That's not for adoption. We don't have a situation here where a child has been formally adopted and then father tries to file a recognition of parentage in order to somehow gain custody. This is pre-adoptive custody.
You're right, Your Honor, and that's a tough question. I would just argue that the consent prohibits it, it bars it.
I have a more basic question for you also, Ms. Flynn. So I just want to clarify for your interpretation of and reading of 259.49, 257, as well as 259.47, is it your position that these statutes and all the other ones that have been referenced, Do you argue or take the position that any of them are ambiguous in any way, shape, or form, or would you agree that we just need to apply the plain meaning of these statutes?
I would not. Correct, Your Honor. I would agree with the latter, that they all need to be read in conjunction. That's how the legislature intended for them. 259.5.2. I would say 257.5.8 speaks to that in terms of the limitations of actions and the recognition of parentage.
I'm sorry, can you repeat that statute that you just mentioned again?
The limitation statute in 257.5.8, Your Honor. I would state that that provides guidance on how to read all those statutes together in terms of a parent or a presumed parent being able to bring an action or an action is barred by the language specifically in 259.5.2.
Ms. Flynn, I'm interested in also in hearing your argument as to good faith.
Your Honor, are you referencing good cause?
Or good cause for the untimely filing by the father.
I would argue the good cause exception, the good cause language in the statute was misapplied by the district court. The district court in both its orders references good cause as to the action. So the district court said that putative father was not required to initiate a paternity action altogether. However, the statute specifically states good cause as to initiating the action after 30 days. The good cause does not excuse the action altogether. It merely allows additional time.
Well, when you say it doesn't excuse the action altogether, the action had actually already begun based upon the mother's filing.
And I would disagree with that, Your Honor, respectfully, to say that that's not the case, because the action, as cited in the statutes twice over, requires putative father to initiate the action, not respondent mother.
Well, the statute certainly indicates father's rights, but where in the statute does it expressly indicate that father and only father can initiate the proceeding?
That's in two sections, Your Honor. Section 259.49, specifically subdivision 1, paragraph B, paragraph 8, section 4, where it says, within 30 days of receipt of the father's adoption registry notice, has initiated a paternity action, unless for good cause shown, he is unable to do so within the 30 days. This is repeated, Your Honor, in 259.5.2, subdivision 10, which says, within 30 days of receipt of the notice to registered putative father, the intent to claim parental rights form, I'll keep reading down. Sorry, Your Honor. It says, stating that he intends to initiate a paternity action within 30 days of receipt of the notice. And further down, if good cause is shown, the putative father must be allowed more time to initiate the paternity action.
No, I understand that. You've cited provisions indicating what the father's rights are. I'm trying to get a sense of why you believe the district court, acting on its inherent authority, is prohibited from allowing a proceeding filed by someone other than the father. I haven't heard anything in those statutes that expressly preclude mother from initiating the proceeding.
I would.
Aren't these statutes in place simply to establish the father's rights, to make sure that father has an opportunity, as opposed to intending to preclude mother or anyone else from initiating the proceeding?
That's true, Your Honor, but the facts in this case indicate that this hasn't been about father's actions. This has been about mother's actions. And I would return the court's attention to 257.58, and I apologize if I tripped over that earlier, to say that that's consistent with what Your Honor is saying about anyone can bring an action. But it references 259.52, bringing it back to the requirement for putative father to initiate that action.
So how does your interpretation, how does your intent for strict application of the statute, which doesn't expressly preclude, you're suggesting it implicitly precludes, but doesn't expressly include the proceeding from going forward on mother's filing. How does that approach square with the constitutional degree, the constitutional quality of the father's rights, the biological father's rights to contest an adoption and to maintain a parental relationship with the child?
Well, Your Honor, I would return the court's attention to Heidbreder versus Carton, as cited in my brief, which references federal Supreme Court law of Lehrer versus Robertson, about how the parents' rights are inherent. They have the biological connection, but really where their constitutional rights come from is when they take advantage of the opportunity of that biological connection through actions of responsibility, which is addressed in our Minnesota statute in 25949, subdivision 1, paragraphs 1 through 7 of section B, where it states what a parent needs to do to show that responsibility: being on the birth certificate, living with the mother, providing support, being adjudicated the father. That is where that constitutional protection lies, and that does not apply in this case because none of those facts exist and apply to respondent putative father.
Ms. Flynn, I have one last question. I realize we're running out of time, so certainly feel free to provide an answer. And as the presiding judge, I have that luxury to be able to do that. I just want to follow up to Judge Ross's question. My understanding is under Minnesota Statute Section 257.57, Subdivision 3, it does note and states, quote, an action to determine the existence of the father and child relationship with respect to a child who has no presumed father under Section 257.55 may be brought by the child, the mother, or a man alleged or alleging himself to be the father. That seems to give mother the opportunity to file a paternity action as well, doesn't it?
Again, Your Honor, she has to have standing in order to initiate that action, Your Honor. And I have to go back to 257.58. That's how you read all these sections in conjunction. It specifically points out 259.52, and that specifically states putative father's requirement to initiate an action.
So that overrides 257.57, which would allow a mother to try to seek to have a putative father adjudicated as the father of her child.
Your Honor, 257.58 says, except as otherwise provided in section 259.52. So I would agree with that assessment.
And okay.
To conclude, Your Honor, if I may just add, based on that invalid ROP, based on the fact that the good cause was applied incorrectly, the order should be reversed. The case should be remanded to be heard on respondent mother's adoption consent alone. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Flynn. And you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well. Counsel for respondent, if you can state your name for the record and the party you're representing, and you'll have 15 minutes as well.
You're muted, I believe, Ms. Geer.
Thank you, Judge. Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. My name is Autumn Geer. I am here today in cooperation with the ICWA Law Center, representing respondent father and arguing in support of the joint brief of respondents. Your Honors, I believe there's only one issue in this matter, and that is whether father's consent is required in order for the adoption proceeding to move forward in light of the recognition of parentage that was signed between mother and father. Contrary to appellant's arguments, the district court did not revoke mother's consent, nor did the district court waive the requirement that father initiate a paternity action within 30 days of his receipt of the registry notice. Simply, the district court applied the plain language of the parentage and adoption statutes and correctly and properly dismissed the adoption proceeding where the rope conclusively established father's paternity in the child, which then gave him right to notice of the adoption proceedings and required that he consent to the adoption. Because father has not consented, the adoption cannot move forward. And this court should affirm the district court's decision based on that.
Well, Ms. Geer, even though the district court did not revoke a mother's consent, which was an irrevocable consent, didn't she basically discover a loophole here in order to allow her, even though she irrevocably agreed to consent to foster parents to adopt, she now has effectively found a way to get custody by, excuse the pun, roping in father to sign an ROP, which allows her now to get custody. How is that fair? How is that not an absurd result, which is contrary to even a plain reading of these statutes?
I understand your question, Your Honor, and true, appellants have argued that there is an element of conspiracy present in this matter. However, it's important to remember that mother and father have two separate sets of constitutionally protected rights. And whether mother has consented and that consent became irrevocable, that is separate from father's ability to abide by the requirements of the MFAR statute as well as execute a rope. And understandably so, the ability of a father to execute a rope with a willing mother at a late stage in the adoption, but in this situation, it is not a late stage in the adoption, but the ability for a father to execute a rope with a willing mother at just about any stage before a child is adopted is allowed by the statutory framework that the legislature has put in place. And I think that there is an argument that has been considered by the Minnesota Supreme Court in the matter in the paternity of JAV, which basically considers the same policy argument that you've presented, Your Honor, and notes that where a decision of the court creates any type of delay or lack of finality based upon the court's analysis of the statutory framework as the legislature has put it in place, it is not the duty of the courts, rather it's the duty of the legislature to change the statutory scheme and weigh the balances of interest.
That is true, that it is certainly not, we are only an error-correcting court. We are not a policy-setting court like the Minnesota Supreme Court or the legislature. They're the only ones that can change the statute. But at the same time, we do need to look at all these statutes in conjunction with each other and make sure that it doesn't lead to an absurd result. We do have the power to look at it from that perspective. Why shouldn't we look at it from that perspective then?
This court should not look at the matter from the perspective of this creating an absurd result, because the Minnesota Adoption and Parentage Acts are put in place in order to allow one, punitive fathers or, you know, unwed fathers to assert their rights and establish a legal relationship with children, and to do it expeditiously, expediently, and quickly. The rope itself, in comparison to a paternity action, executing a rope is a much more efficient way of establishing this legal relationship, which is constitutionally protected. In the event of a parentage action that could possibly take years and joining various parties and create additional delay. So considering whether or not there is an absurd result, I believe that the rope is still just allowing a father to assert his rights in the same way that he could through a paternity action.
So why is it that in essence, what we're allowing here then is a putative father to override a consent, an irrevocable consent that had been previously provided by mother? Why should 259.49 be able to override that consent that had already been given? And as you acknowledge, the district court didn't even revoke that. The district court acknowledged that was in place. How do we reconcile that?
That can be reconciled with the fact that we're still dealing with two parties with two separate sets of rights. Where father shows up, like respondent father has in this situation, and does everything that he can, acting as a pro se party, to establish his rights and interest in the child, he, as respondent father has demonstrated, has shown that he has established a legal relationship with the child, and thus he is entitled to also consent. I believe it's section 2.59.24 requires consent from both parents. So whether or not mother's consent is irrevocable, just to put it bluntly, is irrelevant to the fact that a father who has shown up and asserted his legal rights to the child and established a relationship is still entitled to consent and notice of the proceedings.
Are you aware of any provision in law that would prohibit mother from assisting the biological father from asserting his rights?
I apologize, Your Honor. I just want to make sure I understood. Any law that would prohibit mother from assisting father?
Right. Are you aware of any provision in the law, any constitutional provision, any statutory provision, any provision in the rules that would restrict mother from assisting father in his effort to assert his constitutional rights to a relationship with the child?
No, Your Honor, I am not aware of any such provision, and I believe that some of the case law and authority cited in this case by both of the parties demonstrates that within the Minnesota statutory framework, that type of restriction is not present. And what I'm thinking of is pointing to the Oregon statute, which in a way would limit a mother who has consented from assisting a father in executing a rope.
Ms. Geer, that was going to be my question. I'm assuming it wasn't in the consent, but would it be a proper provision in a consent to adopt to agree not to assist father, and that would hence be enforceable to essentially prohibit the facts here of a rope and her participation in the rope itself?
So I believe that it is up to the legislature to decide whether or not such a provision should be implemented. The legislature needs to weigh the balance of allowing two parties who voluntarily acknowledge that they are both the natural parents of the child. The legislature needs to weigh whether or not we need to cut off that avenue in order to quickly and efficiently establish paternity.
So you don't believe a mother could, as part of a consent to adopt, agree voluntarily not to take part in a rope?
I guess if you're asking for my belief, I believe that potentially, yes, she could. However, that's not what occurred in this situation, and we need to read the plain language of the statute, in which there are no restrictions on mother's ability to enter into a recognition of parentage with a willing father after she has signed a consent and that consent has become irrevocable. And so because in this matter, the parties have executed a recognition of parentage, and that has not been revoked or vacated by the parties who can do those actions, which are mother and father, that Rope entitles father to consent to the adoption, and he has not done so.
Ms. Geer, I have several related questions. First of all, I'm going to ask you the same question I asked Ms. Flynn. With all the different statutory provisions we have here, are there any in particular, thinking 259.49 specifically, but any of the other ones, is it your position that any of these are ambiguous at all?
No, Your Honor, I do not believe that the statutes are ambiguous. And as I've been saying, for risk of sounding like a broken record, the district court applied the plain language correctly.
Okay, and I wanted to get back to, I do think there are actually two issues here, with all due respect. I think one is whether 259.49 subdivision 1B7 applies, or whether we should be looking at 259.49 subdivision 1B8. And under 1B8, that invokes the, requires invocation of the good cause shown issue. And with respect to that, and there are a number of cases that have looked at good cause, including the TD case, and there's an unpublished case as well, MLH. But it seems like those cases have applied a fairly strict good cause standard. And in fact, in those cases, I believe they didn't even, despite some rather egregious facts, did not find that the good cause standard had been met. Are you aware of any case law that has applied the good cause standard and found that a party has met the good cause standard?
I am not currently aware of any case law showing that the good cause standard has been met. However, the facts of the incident case involving respondent father can be distinguished from the cases that you are referencing, in that respondent father is not sleeping on his rights. Specifically in the TD case, that father was claiming that the court didn't tell him what to do in you know, just general terms. But here, respondent father has done just about everything possible as a pro se party within the statutory framework to assert his legal relationship with the child. And it appears the question is, what else could respondent father have done? I am not certain that there is anything else that he could have done, just regardless of what appellants argue.
And one last kind of related question is, as I mentioned, it seems like there's two issues in terms of 259.49 subdivision 1B7 and 1B8. And counsel for appellant has stated in the brief right up front that this seems to be an issue of first impression here. And would you agree with that? And if so, do you think it's an issue of first impression with respect to 1B7 or 1B8 or both?
Your Honor, I disagree. I do not believe that these are issues of first impression. These are statutory interpretation issues, and just plainly applying the statutes as they are presented to the facts of the case. And I believe that the district court properly applied the statutes in this matter.
Okay, thank you.
So if there are no further questions, just to address the good cause argument, I would just like to say that in addition to the recognition of parentage, father is also entitled to notice, and his consent is required in the adoption proceeding because he showed good cause for not initiating a paternity action within 30 days of his receipt of the registry notice. And that has to do with the fact that father filed an answer and countercomplaint, as he was directed to do so by court administration, into the paternity action that mother had already initiated. And it is very unlikely that a separate paternity action would have led to any different result in light of the recognition of parentage. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Geer. Ms. Flynn, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. You have your, you need to unmute. There you go.
Thank you very much. First, I would start by, again, reminding the court of the slippery slope that we allow if we allow the judicially created exception here of revoking a consent by the use of a rope.
Can I take you off your argument for a minute? Because there's a fundamental concern that I have with your position. I'm not sure if this is really a case of good cause in the delaying of a filing. Your position is, well, Father never actually filed, so that's not about a timeliness issue. My problem is the findings of the district court are clear. These are the findings, and those findings aren't disputed that on appeal, which is that Father, and I'm going to quote here, went to court to initiate a paternity action. That's number one. Number two, he was told that he could not initiate one. And number three, and this is the one that's most significant to me, he was not allowed to initiate a parenting a paternity action. So according to the district court, through its own agents in the clerk's office, apparently, prohibited him from filing the paternity action. So in light of that, and you want us to conclude that, well, he never actually filed one, so this isn't about good cause for delay because he never actually did it. If the district court prohibited Father from exercising a right that you say is necessary to him establishing paternity and custody, how is it at all consistent with Father's constitutional rights to prohibit him from proceeding?
You know, I would just go back to Heidbreder versus Carton, like I said earlier, Your Honor, in terms of his rights are protected at the level at which he establishes that responsibility derived from his biological connection.
I'd like you to get to my question, though. In this case, I mean, you cited cases for good cause. Is there any case you have found anywhere where the court steps in, the court, and prohibits Father from initiating a paternity action? You don't deny that he had a right to initiate a paternity action. He attempted to initiate a paternity action, and according to the district court found that the district court did not allow him to pursue that right. Are you aware of any case anywhere in which Father is prohibited in this way from exercising his parental rights?
I am not aware of any case, Your Honor. However, I would argue in this case, it wasn't the district court who rejected his attempts. It was the administrator. They had the information incorrect. And TD versus AK shows that lack of knowledge in this
case. The administrator of what?
Court administration. So
you don't understand that the court administration is an arm of the court? That if the court administration acts to prohibit an individual, it is the court acting to prohibit an individual.
They gave him, I would argue, TD versus AK, that was lack of knowledge. It wasn't the filing, it was the initiation of the paternity action that's different than a filing. He needed to serve the summons and pleadings. Court administration got that wrong. And so as a result, he could have gone and spoken to counsel and still served. They could have consolidated the actions. So in this case, I wouldn't say they prohibited his ability to initiate the action.
Well, this is what the district court found. Father has shown there was good cause for him not to initiate the paternity action, i.e., he was not allowed to. So, according to the district court, he was not allowed. And the district court was expressing in a passive voice that it was the court administrator, that is, an arm of the court that didn't allow him to pursue his rights. And I'm not aware of any, I don't know that your cases for good cause address this circumstance.
I don't know if it serves the case to be discussing whether or not the good cause, I think this is all moot by the fact that the good cause is misapplied, Your Honor. is what I would argue.
What exactly was Father supposed to do? Let's assume the district court's findings are what we rely upon and that they are accurate. And Father was not allowed to initiate a paternity action. And he was not allowed to initiate the paternity action because the court didn't allow him to initiate a paternity action. Exactly what was he supposed to do at this point to demonstrate that he was vigilantly exercising his rights as a father?
To seek counsel. He was still within the 30 days, and counsel would have seen that he could still serve a summons and pleadings, and those could be consolidated. Court administration is not allowed to give legal advice. That's what they usually say when you walk in there and you're attempting to start an action.
That may be what they usually say, but in this case, the court expressly said that Father was not allowed. That was a finding, and I don't believe that your brief challenges the findings of the district court.
I would disagree, Your Honor. I would state that that entire argument falls on the basis that they're still using good cause incorrectly. The good cause is as to the action itself, not to the timing of it. So
I thought your argument was that good cause is limited to good cause to extend the timing. I thought that was your argument.
Right. As to timing, I apologize if I misspoke. As to the timing of it. And so there's no point in entertaining the court. The court did err in saying that there was good cause because he didn't initiate, but that's not what good cause is about.
I'm tending to agree with you. I think the court probably shouldn't have applied a good cause standard because it wasn't about his good cause to have a delayed filing. It was the fact that the court prohibited him from initiating the paternity action. You're right. There's no rule that covers that.
Yes, Your Honor. So
what do you think the consequence should be if the court prohibits him from exercising his rights? What's the remedy to that breach?
Well, then it would go into an equal protection or perhaps a due process argument as to his rights, which again is addressed by Lair and Heidbreder versus Carton. And that goes back to the degree to which he has established his parental responsibility or rights jumping off of his biological connection to the child.
Ms. Flynn, I know we're over time, but this is an interesting question. And I have follow-up questions to Judge Ross's issue that he raised. First is, just to follow up on that last point, it would seem that if the district court, either the district court itself, district court judge, or the administrator expressly prohibited a person from filing the action that's in dispute here, wouldn't that be cause for reversal on appeal in and of itself? Because a putative father would have the right to actually file that action?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. And then the last question I have is, I just want to make sure that I understand. It sounds to me like you're not challenging the underlying finding of fact by the district court that the court administrator did not told him, you can't file this, you have to file a response. You're not challenging the finding of fact, you're challenging the district court's application of the statute, the law, to these particular facts. That's where the district court erred?
Yes, Your Honor, I agree with that.
Okay, so it's not a challenge to the underlying finding of fact?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you. Judge Slater, Judge Ross, any other follow-up questions at all?
No.
Okay. Thank you both very much for your oral arguments and your briefing. We really appreciate it. Very well done. Appreciate you taking the time. We were able to get through this without any glitches, which is always a good thing. We will be issuing an order within the statutory time frame, which I believe in this case is 60 days shorter than the normal 90 days. So it will be an opinion that we will issue within the 60-day time frame. Thank you both very much. Please stay safe and have a good day.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.